And welcome to this week's edition of An Organic Conversation, a show about food, ecology, stories from the land, relationships, and life itself. We're your hosts, Helge Hellberg.
And Mark Mulcahy.
And we're excited about the show today. We have some fantastic guests lined up for you as we are talking about swamp cabbage and other unusual things. But before that, Mark, what's happening?
Well, I'm enjoying summertime, I'm sure, as everybody else is, and I'm enjoying all those Northwest cherries, and Michigan cherries are just starting to pop right now. Apricots are just so soft and wonderful. And then, of course, my favorite fruit is something we're going to talk about today. It was something that has been called the Persian plum, which I know, I'm sure you know exactly what that is.
Of course, Persian plum, all that in What's in Season with Mark Mulcahy in a little while. But yeah, summer is here, mm-hmm. exciting. Mm-hmm. And we're talking about swamp cabbage and other hot things today on the show. Funny food, unusual food, organic food in unusual places. But first.
Yeah, but well, first we get to have Gina Rustani with the Green Headlines.
Thank you, Mark. Some news you may have missed over the long holiday weekend. An ExxonMobil oil pipeline in Montana has ruptured, spilling as much as 42,000 gallons of crude oil into the Yellowstone River, 10 miles west of Billings. The latest reports have the oil traveling 150 miles down the river. In world news, the small island of El Hierro, located in the Canary Islands, 15,000 miles off the coast of Spain, is set to become the world's first island to run off of 100% renewable energy. The $87 million project will provide electricity for the island's 11,000 inhabitants using a combination of wind power and pumped water storage. In Shenzhen, China, a pioneering electric taxi project planned to put 500,000 electric vehicles and plug-in hybrids on the road by 2015. The country is the world's biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, with the largest and fastest growing auto market in the world. But even the government's support and enthusiasm of electric taxi customers, many challenges still remain. Charging stations are few and far between, repair shops are hard to find, and cars are costly. Even after generous government support, a Shenzhen electric taxi costs 80% more than the Volkswagen Santana that ordinarily cruises the streets of Shenzhen. And big news in consumer rights. After a 20-year struggle, the U.S. ends its opposition to genetically modified labeling guidelines with the Global Food Safety Body. This means that any country wishing to adopt genetically modified food labeling will no longer face the threat of a legal challenge from the World Trade Organization. More than 100 countries worldwide have agreed on the labeling of genetically modified food for international fair trade purposes. And in other green news, an astonishing number of new microbes have been discovered in mysterious and uncharted territory. Human belly buttons. Yes, your navel is the inhabitant of potentially some 1,400 bacterial strains. The Belly Button Biodiversity Project brings us the news after collecting as many as 662 microbes that are reportedly new to science. I'm Gina Rustani, and that's this week's Green Headlines. Back to you, Helga.
Thanks, Gina. The belly button news. Yeah. Does it state a difference? Is there a difference between an innie and an outie?
You did a research project on that, didn't you, before?
Yeah, years ago.
Yeah,
though.
Yeah.
And, of course, the innie is way, way superior in that sense. But
oh.
Microbial
yeah. sense, yeah.
I mean, if you saw the fuzz I'm collecting, it's not funny. So it must be true. But anyway, thanks, Gina, for that weekly update. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
We'll take a quick break, but stay tuned for the first interview with filmmaker Julie Kahn and her documentary Swamp Cabbage today on An Organic Conversation, as we are embracing eating wild and the environment and culture around us. More on that and other things when we come back right after the break. Stay tuned.
Tell
And we are back here to an organic conversation. It's summer, it's sweaty, it's swampy. We're talking about belly buttons and a new documentary, Swamp Cabbage. We have a filmmaker here in the studio with us today, the filmmaker of Swamp Cabbage, Julie Kahn, as we are talking about eating wild and embracing the environment and culture around us. Julie, welcome so much to the show.
Hi, thank you. It's great to be here.
It is fantastic to have you. You contacted me a few weeks ago and asked me if I would be part of a fundraiser here on the West Coast of the United States where Floridian food was featured. And I was the MC for a jerky tasting that was featured there, which included some foods I had never seen before, eaten before, and in some parts actually heard of. I did not know that that could be turned into food, and we want to talk about that more. But it prompted us to look at culture, to look at how much we embrace, you know, the concept of eating local and expanding that into the wild foraged areas, all the way into the Floridian swamp. Swamp Cabbage, the new documentary you're working on, tell us about it. Where did the idea come from and what's the movie about?
Well, Swamp Cabbage, a dark and sweaty documentary, the full title, is the story of Haley Downs. She's my co-director and co-producer. And basically, she survives love and loss through an unlikely reckoning with her family and her Florida cracker roots. And the idea for the film came, it actually started as a little bit of a different film. It was a film about her father's wild game feast. Haley was doing a short film about coleslaw wrestling, another food-related film. And I went up with her. We were both living in Miami at the time. I went up with her to her hometown in Central Florida, and just to see coleslaw wrestling, because of course I had to see it. And
what is that? Can you explain? But
so coleslaw wrestling.
I'm imagining now a big bucket of coleslaw with people in it wrestling. That cannot be it.
Pretty much. Well, it's known as the Super Bowl of Bike Week in Daytona Beach, and it's basically in order you have to like amp up your vision a little bit for it, because it's, you know, not just like it's a pit, a massive pit, and it's women in bikinis and wrestling in oily coleslaw.
Kind of like the sauerkraut wrestling they do in Germany, right?
Yeah, probably. Not so much.
It sounds a little more fermented, but yeah.
Yeah, no, nothing like that's going on. Okay.
So we found ourselves up in at coleslaw wrestling, and in a conversation with Haley's father, he started to tell me about his wild game feast. And I was pretty into the food movement at the time. It was sort of more of a nascent food movement. Well, the pre-Michael Pollan food movement, should we say. Well, Michael Pollan, I'm sure, was working on the food movement at the time, but his book had not come out yet. So I was immediately fascinated with the wild game feast, and Haley and I decided to do a film about that. So our motivation was different. I think that for her, it's really clearly exploring her past. And for me, it was really about food and our connection to wild places. Over the years, we started in 99, and it was really about this feast. And then over the years, as life happened, it became more about Haley's life and the background of this culture.
Yeah, what's fascinating for me in that story and in the movie is that, and you showed a kind of a preview, a rough cut at that fundraiser, was that the whatever it may be for you and whatever it may be for Haley, there's a place in the film where it's undifferentiable. It really, the culture and the person become one. And that's really the message, right? That's the beauty, how much Haley, as much as she tried to run away from it and then coming back to it, as much we all are defined by our environments, the environments we have, the environments we keep, the environments we choose, may that be culture, people, food. It's very clear in that movie that she is that person growing up in Florida, being exposed to a whole variety of different foods. Can you talk about that a little bit? What are some of those food memories that you were able to document?
Well, I spent about 2 years living on an abandoned orange grove in Central Florida, documenting some of these cracker food traditions. And
why is it called cracker food?
Yeah, I should. So Florida crackers are the descendants of the original Scotch-Irish settlers of Florida. They came down in the 1800s, partly to escape the sort of long arm of the puritanical Northeast and kind of eke out a living in the wilderness. They were willing to move to Florida, which you can imagine in the 1800s was quite treacherous, in order really to have freedom and to try to struggle to survive.
And we're talking undrained swamp. We're talking mosquitoes.
No air conditioning.
Heat and fever. And
right, exactly.
It's not alligators, insects the size of your hand.
Exactly.
Your head. Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. So it's a not very hospitable.
Not so hospitable. You had to be pretty surly and pretty weird to want to go down there.
Yes.
So, and that these are Haley's ancestors. So basically, a lot of them hunted wild Spanish cows through the wilderness. They were really America's first cowboy. Florida gets a bum rap, but Florida's a big cattle state in America still. And it was the original cattle state.
Yes.
And the frontier, pretty much. And then the West came along and the Hollywood vision of the cowboy came along and really overshadowed Florida. So the Floridians are a little bit, you know, bitter about that, but that's okay.
So the original cowboy, as in it's not the dry Arizona, you know,
right,
camping with the wolves and then you have creeks with trout. This is more, that's really, it started in Florida,
right,
the idea of hunting cattle.
And they were literally hunting these wild Spanish cows. The Spanish had left cows roaming through the swamps. And so they would drive them across the state and put them on boats bound for Cuba to trade them for gold in the markets there. And they were named cracker. There's debate about where the term comes from, but the most popular reasoning is that it comes from the crack of the cattle whip, because they wouldn't hit the cows. They basically were sounding the whip in order to move them out of the brush.
Now, you said that they were hunting cattle, not herding cattle.
Not herding, hunting them, wild cows.
So they had like a cow horn.
They had the whips.
Oh, they had the whips.
Yeah, and the whips were what sounded. They communicated across the swamps with the whips, the crack of the whip, so they knew they could communicate for miles across the swamps that way. And
drive the cows
and drive
out of
the cows
swamp
out
to
of,
shoot them.
Well, if you imagine even like really dense palmetto.
Sure.
I don't know if you know what the palmetto tree is, mm-hmm. You know? I mean, it's like a palm, but lower and very, very dense. And so if the cow's in there, really
hiding,
the only way to get them out is sound.
Sure.
And dogs. Yeah.
We're talking with Julie Kahn here in the studio today, filmmaker from Sausalito, California, and her new movie, Swamp Cabbage, about eating wild and embracing the environment that shapes us and the culture around us. What's the subtitle again?
A Dark and Sweaty Documentary.
So besides cows, at that fundraiser that I attended, there were foods that you would never find as a pre-made food. These are all old home recipes. We had alligator jerky. We had raccoon stew. Where do these recipes come from? Out of necessity, or is that really part of surviving in Florida early and they have maintained their life as a recipe? Or tell us more, what have you found? What other foods are eaten in that region that are basically normal?
Yeah, I think so. The crackers who were in this sort of backwoods environment learned to survive in that treacherous wilderness. And so swamp cabbage itself is made from the heart of the sable palm, which is Florida's state tree. It's a dish that's a cracker delicacy. So it's made from heart of palm. And so they would cut down a sable palm tree, which is hard work. I don't know if you've ever seen that happen, but with an axe, they would cut down a 6-foot palm and get the heart of palm out of it, which is an art in and of itself, and make this dish. So whatever was wild and available in Florida, which included everything from squirrel, is a very popular Florida cracker dish. To have a squirrel, what they called purlieu, was basically almost like a stone soup thing to make the meat go as far as possible. It's like squirrel and community people would bring whatever they could and make this communal dish with rice and some kind of meat, whether it was raccoon, squirrel, armadillo, really whatever was available. Wild boar is very popular, venison, any salt and freshwater fish that's available there. Smoked mullet is delicious and very much a Floridian meal. More exotic stuff like alligator and rattlesnake came along a little bit later. It wasn't really, crackers were smart enough to know, like, you don't really necessarily want it. I mean, they would eat the gator tail as a, once the skin started selling, and it was kind of, you know, you use the whole animal, as we know. But the snake came along, I think, more as like a tourist kind of attraction. Same thing pretty much with alligator. It wasn't really a cracker delicacy.
And I can't say that I've ever had rattlesnake yet. But it reminds me when you were talking about the squirrel would start the pot, right? And the Italians, when they immigrated to California, a chip in stew, right? Cipino. Mm-hmm. And so they would start with a pot and would sit on the stove every day near where they were all fishing or growing, because mm-hmm. there was Italian farmers, right? And each day they would come in and everybody would chip in something, and it became, and they couldn't say chip in, so they called it cipino.
Exactly.
And so it's a similar thing with across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, fascinating. What I also loved was actually the flavor. It was amazing to me that the juiciest of the jerky was the alligator. The hardiest of the dishes was the stew, was the raccoon, which I would have never chosen. And there's just a lot of stigma around unusual foods. Like we tend to stick with, what is it, 13 or 15, 18 ingredients in our cooking, more or less. We're used to what we're used to. And usually stay with that in that realm, even if we have the opportunity. In this case, you know, we don't even maybe have the opportunity. Is this food offered in Florida, actually? Would you get it if you traveled there into the swamps? Because I've been to Florida twice. I don't remember ever seeing alligator on the menu.
I think some of it. I mean, I think you find crackers now in sort of all strata of society and living in and out of connection with the land these days. And some of them eat traditional dishes. But I think at the time it was really out of necessity that people were eating some of these things, and maybe less likely that you're going to find raccoon or squirrel. You can find them more. There's cracker reenactment places where you can find stuff like that. But the things you do find, though, are Florida native things. You'll still find mullet, which is delicious. The things that are delicious and available and specific to Florida.
So you're talking about a culture that I myself have never seen, maybe have heard about a little bit.
You knew swamp cabbage before as a dish, or as
I knew of the hearts of palm, but yes. Never as swamp cabbage. I'd known it from another place. Why is it so important to tell this story?
For me, it's important because, first, I think it shines light on this sort of underexplored and somewhat stereotyped culture. In Florida, I don't think a lot of people have had insight into this culture. And I think it does a lot of things. It pushes the food conversation to its logical next step, which is wild food, I think, in its connection with culture and the environment. I think it helps bridge some rural and urban divides. I mean, I think it's important to tease out the nuances of rural culture and to see this food story through the window, through an unexpected window, which I think cracker culture is.
Well, you know, I'm sitting here listening to both of you, and
so
you both got the opportunity to attend this event. And so I'm sitting here thinking, okay, Helga just mentioned raccoon stew. He just talked about, you know, a couple different types of jerkies. I'd like to know what, Helga, first starting with you, what was your response? I mean, did you have, you had to go it into was, this thing. You yes. had to go into this thing going,
Well, I was asked to be the MC of the jerky tasting, and that was already, I like that idea because I do like jerky. There's, you know, few foods as yummy on the road, whatever. Jerky is just one of those things that is uniquely American. When I first came over, I came for jerky. No, that's not true.
You didn't have it in your knapsack.
It is a big American cultural, and we have dried fish in Europe. We have to make it through the winter. It really became a necessity. It's not that the jerky stick was an invention, but you know, this is to preserve food for the winter months, and drying it or salting it is a tradition in many, many cultures. So I was attracted to that idea. I didn't know what it would do to me, and honestly, having that bowl of raccoon let me realize everything that comes with that dish, the hardship of the people coming here as settlers, creating this country, our detachment from nature to, you know, a fairly extensive degree at this point. Somebody was saying, well, we wanted to bring, I don't know, was it chipmunk? Or like there's another dish around that. And he said, you need, I mean, this was a fundraiser with 200 people attending.
Muskrat, I think.
Yeah. And he was dead serious and said, we need a lot of chipmunks and we couldn't get them. And I my first reaction was laughing, of course.
Because you thought he was joking.
Yeah. And then, and also my naivete around the work that person would have put into preparing 200 chipmunks, because you need about one per person. And it still sounds funny to me. And yet, It's the art of food making. It's a tradition that we have forgotten and never really embraced or didn't even know about. It's the fear of the other. It's like, it's literally on that at that event, life came together as how isolated. I felt extremely isolated in my naive view of, yeah, it was a pretty life-changing event, as is this movie, if you really look between the lines of what it means.
Thank you.
Yeah. So again, with us in the studio is Julie Kahn talking about her movie Swamp Cabbage, a dark and sweaty Floridian story about living and growing up in the Florida swamps and being very much shaped by the food culture, as we all are, even if we live in the city. And that can be a fairly limited experience, or in Haley's case, the main character in that movie, really the all defining energy or force, because she's really she's so fed up in your movie. Let's talk about the movie actually. Okay, when we come back, you're listening. I love this story. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll be right back with more on Swamp Cabbage. Stay tuned.
My name is Earl Herrick, and I am the owner of Earl's Organic Produce, a San Francisco Bay Area distributor fully committed to organic produce. From the time one could find organic fruits and vegetables only in natural food stores to now, when schools and fine restaurants feature organic, we have been forging relationships with growers for over 20 years. If you want to offer the finest organic produce to your employees or customers, find us at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Frey Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Frey never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Frey organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Frey Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines, without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at freywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Sungevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Sungevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Do you feel run down, stressed, overweight, or overloaded? Urban Remedy is a delicious 100% organic juice cleansing program designed to jumpstart your body's natural healing and cleansing abilities. This delicious juice feast, created by leading acupuncturist Nika Pasquale, is rich in vital nutrients, minerals, and enzymes, providing you with all the nutritional nourishment you need to thrive. Delivered directly to your doorstep. Urban Remedy, a convenient way to boost your energy and balance your body. Place your order today at urbanremedy.com. That's urbanremedy.com.
Over 25 years ago, my husband and I started a business around our passion for ginger. We called it the Ginger People. Today, you can find our products at natural food stores nationwide. We love ginger. It's what we do. And the more we learned about the amazing properties of ginger, the more we realized that everyone benefits from eating ginger every day. My name is Abby Leeson, and I am with the Ginger People. To learn more about our products, the goodness of ginger, and how it can improve your health, visit gingerpeople.com. That's gingerpeople.com.
And we are back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today we're talking about eating wild and embracing the environment and culture around us. With us in the studio is Julie Kahn, filmmaker, with her new documentary, Swamp Cabbage, a dark and sweaty survival guide. And we'll dive more into that movie, the story, and what we've all learned from it, watching the trailer and rough cut. But first, as always, one of my favorite segments, here's Mark Mulcahy with What's in Season.
And so if you haven't figured out what a Persian plum is, it's peaches. Yay!
Hey, peaches.
My favorite fruit, my absolute favorite fruit. As a matter of fact, here's my day changer for you. If you want to change your day from maybe you're a little grumpy after work, or maybe you just need a little something to change your perspective, go to a farmer's market, go to a store, walk up to that, those beautiful round fuzzy globes that are peaches, and just bend down and stick your nose right in the middle of the pile of them. I used to drive my daughters nuts when I did this. But I tell you what, that fragrant aroma that comes up, it can literally change your day. I'm serious. You pull your head out of there and then you grab a bag and fill it up. But just literally, that's, it could be that different. It's not wild food, but it can sure give you a wild sense of feeling better. And where I would like to start today with peaches, instead of the usual spot of choosing, is what's in a name? We all have names and they're all important. It's what we are called. And we've relegated the peach to yellow and white peaches. And I would really like to have you to think about, when you taste a peach you like, to ask the farmer or ask the produce clerk, what is the name of that peach? Because there are red tops, there are O. Henry's, there are sun crusts out there, and they all have different components that are going to make you enjoy them. So when you go pick out peaches, think about what the name of that peach is, and the next summer you'll know when those are around and which one you want. When you are choosing them, you want to look for fragrant, as I just mentioned, smooth, firm, and brightly colored fruit that gives slightly to the gentle palm pressure. And when you get them home, there's two important things you want to remember this time of year. First is that you want to, after the 4th of July, you want to eat your peaches a little firmer than you normally would. You usually let them get fairly soft. But peaches after around the 4th of July tend to get mealier quicker. So you want to eat your peaches firmer. Don't let them get as soft as you normally would. Secondly, it's been a really rainy year in peach growing areas. So that means there's a possibility of something called brown rot, which where you get them home, you ripen them on the counter, and a little brown spot occurs. Well, that happened because of all the wet weather. What you want to know about there is there's nothing wrong with that peach. It has a little brown spot. You can cut it out and still enjoy amazing peaches. You could buy conventional peaches, but one of the things you want to consider there is that, see, organic growers can't use conventional synthetic fungicides to keep that fungus off of the fruit. And peaches are number 4 on the Environmental Working Group's list of produce items that have fruit that have the most pesticide residues. So it's worth cutting it out. You're going to get a fantastic peach. But I just want to let you know that that is going to happen this year. And doesn't happen every year, but it happens on years when it's been particularly rainy. So if you are going to take them home and you've got firm peaches, you can leave them out at room temperature for about 1 to 3 days and they should ripen up just fine. As usual, you can always put them in a bag and ripen them up sooner, a brown bag, but keep your eye on them. And here's a thing that you need to remember. If you're going to have them in your refrigerator or if you're going to have them outside of your fridge, 1 day at room temperature equals 6 or 7 days in your refrigerator. So if you did put them in your refrigerator after they were ripe, it would take that much longer to ripen them. Lastly, just like plums that I was talking about, plums when we had it in what's in season, you want to bring your cold peaches and let them get room temperature. You want to have it. That allows them to bring out their full flavor and allows, so when you put them on your cereal or you put them on your ice cream or when you just take them and sit outside and close your eyes and take a big old bite of them, that allows you to get the full, wonderful summer flavor out of them. And that's your What's in Season for this week.
Thank you, Mark. Mark Mulcahy, What's in Season, peaches. Yes. Wow. Beautiful and at the peak of ripeness right now, depending on the variety, right?
Depending on the variety.
Depending on the variety. What's your favorite? I do like the O. Henry's.
Mine, I mentioned my three favorites today. Red top, O. Henry's, and Suncrest.
What about the donut little thingies?
I like them, but there's a texture there that isn't quite what I want from a peach.
Yeah.
And I like it. I thoroughly would enjoy it if we had some, but yellow peaches are my favorite, even over white peaches, donut peaches, you name it. Yellow peaches are still my favorite fruit.
But you did try that donut to know, and that's what this show is all about, talking about eating wild and embracing the environment and culture around us because we are shaped by it if we want it or like it or not. With us in the studio is Julie Kahn, filmmaker, from Sausalito, California, and her new documentary, Swamp Cabbage, A Dark and Sweaty Survival Guide. Julie, thanks again for joining us. And we talked before the break about the foods I tried at that fundraiser for your movie, what it has done to me. I just want to add before we ask you what was your favorite part there. The taste is unusual in some of those foods. I mean, I can't say that every single dish was overwhelmingly delicious in that sense. It's really unusual is the best term. It's not that it's not yummy. But for example, raccoon has a pretty hefty metal taste to it at the end. And maybe mm-hmm. that was just that recipe, but mm-hmm. I'd never had raccoon before. It brought up all these questions I had about my environments and how my food world is fairly limited and how glad I was I came and I tried it. And yet I'm not sure if I will have raccoon soon again.
Mm-hmm. You might like a raccoon that's been eating different things than the ones that
that's,
you tasted.
Yes, so
keep an open mind.
Raccoon is not like raccoon. And I'm sure a stew is different than barbecuing it.
Or, definitely.
And, well, just like we were talking about with the peaches, is like Bay Area raccoon versus Florida raccoon versus, do they have raccoons in Germany?
Yes.
Okay, well, I didn't know if they have.
Wait. I'm sure, yeah.
The little bandit? Little.
No, actually, we don't.
Yeah.
No.
So you would have, that would have never even, no matter even out of necessity, it never would have been
there. We have badgers.
Oh.
That counts.
Probably.
Right-ish.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. No, we'd have to try badger
don't know
stew.
What they eat.
So. And the great thing about you trying that, Helga, and is that that could be the chipmunk dish or the muskrat dish or the raccoon stew. Someone grew up with that, and
yes.
that was their favorite thing. They look forward to having that on certain occasions.
Sure.
I made the same mistake we always do, which is when you say, I don't like grapes, when somebody says that, it's maybe the... you know, a variety that was not ripe, whatever the circumstances are why that person is not enjoying the experience, it has nothing to do with them not liking grapes, because there might be 400 different varieties at different times of the year mm-hmm. in different circumstances mm-hmm. and you like it. So thank you, Julie, for that reminder, because for me to say, I'm not sure if I have raccoons to again, I can't wait to have it again to see if there's one version I actually
when
really
we go
love.
To Florida, when we go to the when we go to the Swamp Cabbage Festival, we're gonna have to try some.
Yes. We want to talk about more about the movie itself. And we also have the idea of eating wild and embracing the environment expanded all the way into permaculture today. We have a great guest coming up. Jenny Pell from Permaculture Seattle is joining us today on a call from Seattle. But first, here's our beloved chef Sita with
The Holistic Bite.
Thank you. Thanks for the introduction. Wow, what a diverse food that we're talking about today. Raccoon
no kidding.
And peaches. So peaches. Wow, if I had my little way, I'd eat peaches every day, just like Mark, right? That song has been in my head all week because the peaches this week are unbelievable. So many people will put peaches in the same sentence as nectarines, as kind of the fuzzier stepsister of the nectarine. But I've been eating so many peaches this season because they're so great. And I have to say, they are in a league of their own. And eating these peaches has kind of brought out the country bumpkin in me.
Perfect for the show.
Perfect for the show.
Do they have Bay Area crackers?
You know, I actually think that they do. Because whoever the pioneers were in the Bay Area, I don't know whether it's hillbilly or what the name technical term. I mean, I know in sort of, I think, Anderson Valley, they have the Bunt people.
Okay.
And I think that people that are sort of generations, with people with generations long ties to the land, mm-hmm. I think would be the equivalent of a cracker wherever you are.
Mm. So I'm sorry, Sita.
Oh, no, no problem. Very interesting. Well, peaches... something that most people do enjoy, most people have had and enjoyed, probably because they're so sweet. They're like candy, right? They're just such a fabulous dessert. And that is the recipe that I'm going to talk about today, a great peach dessert recipe. But before we get to the goodies, I want to tell you why this is good for you. Peaches are yellowish. Can we say yellowish, Mark? Yellowish in color. Although there are a lot of varieties of color. You've got white and pink in there, but really yellowish. And what that tells me is that they're high in carotenoids. carotenoids, which is a phytonutrient that is good for your eye health as well as your heart health. And peaches also contain vitamin A and vitamin C. So not just tasty, also good for you. And as often as possible, I prefer to eat peaches raw. I know I say that a lot. I think that's the best way for you to get a sense of what it tastes like. But I come from a raw food cooking background, or an uncooking background, as the case may be. And I think the best way to protect the nutrients of these really delicate fruits is to eat them raw, not heat them at all. So the recipe today for white peach sorbet is raw, mostly raw. And it's funny, I have white peach sorbet written down here, and Mark was like, well, I don't want to say white peach. Let's call it by its name. I can tell you, Snow Bright was the name of the peaches that I picked up at the farmer's market that were just so delicious and used to make my white peach sorbet, which is the easiest dessert in history. The only thing easier is to just eat it right out of your hand. So the nice thing about the recipe that I'm providing for all of you on organicconversation.com and Facebook and Organic Conversation is that you could use the same technique to make any kind of fruit sorbet. So when blackberries are seasoned, you can make blackberry sorbet. But today we're talking about peaches. So let me give you a little tip about this recipe. This recipe has, I guess we can say, maybe a little secret added boost from Grand Marnier, which is an orange-flavored liqueur. And the secret phenomenon that happens when you add Grand Marnier or any kind of liqueur to your sherbet or your sorbet, pardon me, is that it has a lower freezing point. So what it does is it prevents the sorbet from crystallizing in your freezer. So I only add about a tablespoon. It's not very boozy. But if you wanted to make a more adult version of it, you could certainly go ahead and add another tablespoon of your liqueur of choice. Just be careful because that flavor, like Mark was saying, is so delicate. You don't want to overpower that. So today's recipe, white peach or Snow Bright peach sorbet on anorganicconversation.com. Thank you so much. This has been this week's Holistic Bite.
Delicious. Awesome. Thank you. Chef Sita, naturalist Chef Sita Bryan with us every week. Wonderful. Yes. For more recipes by Sita, Chef Sita, go to Facebook and Organic Conversation. Thank you. Wonderful. We'll try that. Today we are talking about eating wild and embracing the environment and culture around us. With us in the studio here on Organic Conversation is Julie Kahn, filmmaker with her new movie Swamp Cabbage, a dark and sweaty survival guide. Julie, how was that for you to be exposed to those foods? This is not in your past either.
No, even though I was born in Miami and I'm a second generation Floridian, just because you're born in Florida doesn't mean you can be called, you can call yourself a cracker. So if I knew how to hunt a wild hog and wrestle an alligator, I probably could call myself
you would
a cracker.
Qualify.
Yeah. But it was for me as a kind of food nerd at the time, discovering all these wild foods was incredible because as one of the cracker families that cooked at one of our wild game feasts said, he made a soft shell turtle stew. And he said that everyone said it tastes like chicken and it enraged him. He said, soft shell turtle doesn't taste like chicken. Garfish doesn't taste like chicken. Gator meat doesn't taste like chicken. People just don't know what to say. And right. I think that's so profound because we've lost the language even to talk about these diverse foods. We can't even, you know, have a moment that's internal and have nuance around the food.
Yes, the language of flavor. We talk about that all the time. We do manifest in the language of flavor. Beautiful. And we want to talk about more the movie, where people can watch it, what your timeline on is. You're just finishing it now. But we also want to expand the conversation beyond food today. And with us now, calling in from Seattle, Washington, is Jenny Pell. She's a core member of Permaculture Now Seattle. Jenny, thanks for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
And Jenny, we're talking about eating wild and embracing the environment and the culture around us. And that goes beyond food. You have been a tree planter, helicopter pilot, carpenter. You have an extensive past, and you are now part of that Permaculture Now Seattle group, working on really fascinating projects to bring natural environments as it relates to energy and water specifically, and many other areas, into the urban landscape, into our understanding how much we are shaped by our natural environments. Can you tell us a little bit more about permaculture? What's the idea behind it, and what do you do?
Well, permaculture is essentially a design approach to to human settlements. And I know that sounds kind of trite, but what we really look at is a whole systems approach to shelter, water, waste, food, energy, hub and hearth, education, just a whole, a much bigger paintbrush swath of human design. And when we look at permaculture design, it's about designing for those people in that place. And that's one reason that it's able to be so successful worldwide. And what I find in the Pacific Northwest, where I live, is we're all, almost everybody that I work with are people that are fairly recently moved to the area. So how do we get people to look at the vernacular and building? Well, we're never going to build long houses again. And so how do we start to, you know, shape our architecture and shape our designs so that they're appropriate for living in this environment? And how do we add in elements that make them energy efficient and cost effective and beautiful and have a hearth and have a neighborhood central node that allows us to share resources and know each other? So we look at this incredibly diverse and interesting and complex web of human relationships in the natural environment. So I get to specialize in things like edible landscapes in the urban environment, and I get to look at what we call the invisible structures, which is how we shape the contracts between each other, whether they're financial or social or legal contracts. We look at all these different nuances so that we can start to craft a much more holistic approach to where we live right now.
So how else is permaculture used in communities around the country? I mean, you said that it's about those people in that place. And so can you give us some other examples? You told us what you're involved in up in Seattle. Can you give us some other examples of what might be going on around the country using permaculture?
So for example, if you live down in Santa Fe, where water is a more scarce resource versus where I live, where it rains and rains and rains and rains and rains. So you're looking in the Southwest, you're looking at a passive solar design that's cooling and stores water and has a landscape that at every single possible way, you're looking for redundant water systems that are going to infiltrate water into the landscape. And where I'm living and working, I'm looking at ways to maximize my solar gain so that it's bright and sunny and warm, and that I'm, you know, trying to move water through the landscape. And I'll still have redundant systems, but not have it pooled in places that I don't want.
And design, a new design approach to life really doesn't end at the farm gate or at the city gate. This is not an urban or rural solution, right? This is an approach wherever you live to look at your kind of microcosm, your house and your garden, and for the larger community in those areas as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So it can be urban, it can be suburban, it can be rural, it can be on a farm, it can be, the true permaculture landscapes are, you go to the indigenous food forests. And, great teachers for us in terms of learning how to look at the different layers of the canopy down to the ground covers and mimic that in our designs. One of my favorite statistics recently has been that a garden is four times more productive than a farm. So if you think about using, the vertical spaces and, trellises and arbors and how intensively and in a diverse way to plant your backyard or your front yard or your neighborhood, your planting strip, where you're accessing it all the time. It's very different than walking out to the fields and putting it in straight lines in production. So you get a much larger array of food crops to pick from that might only have a smaller yield, but if it's just for your family, then that's different.
And as we are, as permaculture looks at a design approach for specific areas for, site-specific circumstances and regional circumstances. As you said, in a drought-prone area, the focus on water might be much higher than, in an area that has lots of rainfall, whereas there it might be the heating of the buildings, right? You can adjust permaculture according to what's needed.
Yeah, one of the neat designs I saw recently was in Tokyo. They were experimenting with sweet potatoes on the roofs of the skyscrapers. And they were finding that the sweet potato cover is so thick and it transpires water so effectively through the root, through the leaves of the plant, that it would just colonize the whole top of the skyscraper and actually cool the building by about 4 degrees centigrade.
Oh my God, that's so fascinating.
And feed the people in the skyscraper too.
And that food crop. And then, in Arizona, one of my colleagues was hired to do a design to how can they expand the air conditioning units in their building And how can they do that? You know, what's the best way, and how much more do we need? And what he did ended up designing was a huge trellis on the south side of the building that was green that actually reduced the air conditioning needs for the building. And he also planted trees in the parking lot that gave shade to the cars and put picnic benches and places to sit for the employees. And then the overall permaculture design resulted in higher employee satisfaction, lower attrition, you know, better production,
sure,
as well as lower energy bills.
Well, we call it, we often hear that term biomimicry, but in this case, you're actually not mimicking anything. You're just embracing what's there, and you use nature, really natural forces, natural logic, ecology in a way, in designing more, you know, things that are more in line with what is, actually.
Absolutely. And permaculture is based on, what I love about permaculture and why, to me, it works so well, cross cultures, cross economic divides, cross religions, is that it has an ethical framework with a solid set of principles that we refer to in our
yes.
design process. So the ethics are really straightforward. Care for the earth, care for people, and to share the surplus. And so when we look at our design process, it's how can we in our everyday decisions not be damaging the planet? How can we design for that? It's really all about us. If we left Gaia to herself, she would do just fine. And so how do we start to live really large on a very small footprint rather than living really large on an enormous footprint, which is not working at all? And so that first ethic, how do you care for the earth?
Sure.
And care for people is the second ethic, is how do we design to be, you know, put our community and put our families in this big embrace of abundance and resilience and thriving local economies and interesting networks of creative expression for humans and redundant systems that are serving us in a way that's adding to a biodiverse base around us.
Jenny, if people want to get involved in that work or learn more about it, what's your website? How can people study more about permaculture?
Well, permaculture is available in every country. So you can just put in permaculture, you know, Tamil, you know, provinces in India. You know, you can put in permaculture into the specific African country you're looking for. Permaculture is very alive and well all over the United States. We have in the Pacific Northwest, we have a really active permaculture group all up and down the West Coast. The East Coast has their own flavor on it, and I don't get back to the East Coast very often, but I know they have really busy permaculture groups back there. So you just would, you know, I would just go straight to a Google search. You can look up permaculture. You can go to YouTube videos and find just about anything that you want. And I would put in a specific city or town or region that you're looking in, and you'll network very quickly.
And you're with Permaculture Now Seattle. If people look up that, they can follow your amazing work. Jenny Pell, the core member of Permaculture Now Seattle, calling us from Seattle, Washington. Thank you so much for all your incredible work and for embracing the environments that nurture us in so many ways, more ways than we often know about. Thank you for being part of an organic conversation today.
You're very welcome.
I'm Helge Hellberg.
I'm Mark Mulcahy.
Fascinating work. We'll be right back with more on eating wild and embracing the environment and culture around us here in an organic conversation. Stay tuned.
Fry Vineyards is America's first organic winery, family owned and operated since 1980. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Fry organic and biodynamic wines include delicious Cabernet Sauvignon, Zinfandel, Syrah, Chardonnay, and Sauvignon Blanc. Fry Vineyards Mendocino County award-winning wines without added sulfites. Available at grocery stores and online at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com.
Produce is ever-changing, seasons coming and going. At Earls Organic, we have been sourcing solely organic produce for over 20 years. Since 1988, Earls Organic Produce has been establishing strong relationships with growers and developing a deep understanding of the seasons, so you can offer the most delicious organic produce to your customers, staff, and clients year-round. For organic produce, visit Earls Organic Produce at earlsorganic.com. That's earlsorganic.com.
Sungevity, a company specializing in residential solar, is on a mission to bring solar to the mainstream market. Sungevity is changing the solar industry by making solar energy simple, efficient, and affordable for every homeowner. In most cases, Syngevity doesn't even need to visit your home to provide an estimate. Just plug in your address and we'll use satellite images and aerial photography to determine your home's solar potential. Go to Syngevity.com or call 866-SUN-4ALL to make going solar a reality today.
Hi, my name is Abby Leeson, and I am the co-founder of The Ginger People. You can find our products in natural food stores near you. From delicious ginger drinks, sauces, spreads, ginger chews, baked goods, to skincare products. We love ginger. It's what we do. Add the benefits of ginger to your life, and you get that little kick, too. I am Abby Leeson, and I'm with The Ginger People. For inspiration around ginger, go to gingerpeople.com. That's gingerpeople.com.
And we are back here to an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg.
And I'm Mark Mulcahy.
And today with us, Julie Kahn in the studio from Sausalito, California, filmmaker with her documentary Swamp Cabbage, A Dark and Sweaty Survival Guide.
So, Julie, when I was listening to Jenny, I'm sitting there thinking, well, this is the most logical thing in the world, what she's talking about. I don't know why it isn't more of the daily conversation of all of us. But then I was thinking about the crackers in Florida, and they were permaculturists themselves, right?
Oh, exactly. It was take what you need only from the land and live. Cracker architecture is known for being in harmony with the land and maximizing what the earth is already doing.
Do you have an example on that? Like,
With cracker architecture, the houses are oriented in such a way that they'll stay cool in the summertime and, you know, warmer in the wintertime. The mound of ground, because most of Florida is at sea level, so there are very subtle, you know, kind of gradations in the landscape, and so they'll be built in. There are certain clues in nature of what would be less likely to flood in a hurricane or a bad, you know, sea surge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so, I mean, for me, it's like, it just makes so much common sense.
I mean, the crackers were doing all of it. I mean, they were Alice Waters before Alice Waters. Marjorie Kinnon Rollins, who wrote The Yearling and won a Pulitzer for it, lived in a place called Cross Creek in Florida and wrote The Cross Creek Cookery. And in it, she refers to not a local cow, but Dora, her cow. The recipes are written with Dora's milk. And the idea is that you make things with the milk from your own animal.
What has all this done to you? We are talking about eating wild, embracing the environment and culture around us. Your awareness, has it always been this heightened, or has this movie really brought that out in you? What have you learned?
Oh, it's completely brought it out in me. I was terrified of the woods, and I think that's partly what drew me to this story. And I was very involved in food and still am. And the combination of the two, realizing that, you know, basically the woods is full of bounty, and reconnecting with that in the wilderness is really important to connecting to our own, you know, our own wild places, both inside and out, emotionally, as you see through Haley's story, and also the land that is being paved everywhere around us. And with it, culture goes away.
Yes, so true.
Well, and that's what I think we can't know that we're missing.
That's right, if we don't experience.
And so it's, oh, sure, why not just go ahead and pave that field or get rid of that swamp or that type of thing, because we don't have a reference point to it. So it's easy for us to think that that's not important or that doesn't matter, because my reference point is only that it's a swamp that sits across the side of the road that I drive by every day.
Right.
You know, what would I need there? I mean, and this is stuff that you bring up all the time, Helga, about our connection and our relationship to the world around us.
So this movie, Swamp Cabbage, the story of Haley, she not just leaves the swamp, the Floridian swamp, she flees, right? She's
right.
So fed up. Can you describe the story just as an outline?
Sure. I mean, she doesn't think she comes from a place like any kid, you know, but particularly she grew up in kind of hard drinking, gun toting backwoods Central Florida. So she flees at 17, seeking a more like sophisticated life in New York. And
quote unquote.
Right. Exactly. Quote unquote, more sophisticated. And everything changes when her father's diagnosed with cancer and she moves home to help care for him. And pretty much her life kind of spirals downward. And kind of desperate to cope with all of this, she sets out first her father's death, she sets out to make a film about his hunting buddies and their annual hometown wild game feast. And what starts as a documentary about this wild game feast eventually becomes this kind of tragic comic quest. It's a dark story, but it's a funny story, to overcome loss and find love through reconnecting with her checkered past, her family, her inner Florida cracker, and most importantly, the disappearing Florida wilderness.
And you are in a fundraising drive to get this done, right?
We are. We're in post-production. We need funds to hire an editor and pay for music licenses. And
what's the website people can go to?
It is www.swampcabbagemovie.com. And you can donate directly on the website. And look for the film in 2012 or 13, accompanied by Wild Game Feasts.
In 12. Let's just say
in 12. Let's say in 12.
Swamp Cabbage
Sounds
Movie.
Good.
SwampCabbageMovie.com. And do you have other Floridian food culture events planned throughout the country?
We don't have them actually planned yet, but they're sort of
on
in the
website.
Works. Yeah, works. Well, you'll see the past ones on the website along with menus, and the future ones will be up there soon.
Thank you. Mark.
Oh, I was just hoping that we get invited.
Yes, it's awesome.
Of course.
Thank you.
If you go on the website and sign up for the mailing list, you'll be invited.
Julie Kahn on an organic conversation today about Swamp Cabbage, a dark and sweaty survival guide. Thank you for bringing that culture to us and really what it stands for and the questions it brings up. Wonderful.
Yeah, thank you
really
very much.
Important work.
Thank you so much
Looking
for having
forward me. To seeing that movie when it's done.
Me
well,
too.
And you know, like this movie and this discussion we've had every day, it seems to me like every day we get little unexpected gifts, right? That just surprise us. And that's why I always look forward to this moment on the show, Helga's Organic Moment. So what do you got for us today, Helga?
Yeah, and I don't want to take it away from that spirit of culture. I've been, ever since that event, the fundraiser I attended about Floridian food culture and swamp cabbage, I've been watching myself more closely, who I am in which environment, how are my environments, the ones I choose, how do they shape me? What does good food do to my body? What does not so good food feel like? What does a heartfelt conversation really feel like? And who am I becoming in a moment of stress or controversy in conversation in life, in every single circumstance? Of course, one could say these are all just different parts of my overall being, which is entirely true. And yet, which of my parts comes out seems to be entirely based on my outside circumstances and choices. We manifest in the presence of the other, be it food, people, conversations, or natural environments. We become part of that story. We become part of the language of flavor. We become part of possibility. We let it in, and we can experience our response as us. So let it in. Experience your response as you manifesting in this life.
Wow. Every time I get lost in what you're saying almost every week here on this thing, you know, yes, live the story. Be willing to be open to the story. That is just a great lesson for all of us.
Yeah. And as you said, you don't have to like every experience, right? You don't have to like the raccoon stew, but even that has so many facets to it of, you know, where did that raccoon live? Did it have a good life? What food did it eat? Like that's what makes it so rich in life. It's as diverse as we can make it, wherever we go down that path, there are a gazillion circumstances that can change, right? Mm-hmm. That's really the richness of life. It's endless. It's endlessly rich.
So don't be afraid, little piglet. Go out there and experience the story.
Well, or be afraid. Experience your fear. It's totally fine to feel that too. Whatever you feel, it's all experience.
Great. Thanks.
Just make sure it's rich.
Thank you very much for that.
Yeah. And so, that was this week's edition of An Organic Conversation.
An Organic Conversation is a production of the Organic Media Network. Associate producer, Gina Rastani.
If you missed parts of this show or for any other show, go to iTunes or anorganicconversation.com, where your hosts, Helga Hellberg
and Mark Mulcahy.
And we'll be back right here, same place, same time next week. Thanks for joining us. See you then.
Bye-bye now. Beside me